Welcome to the Surviving Society collaborative and ongoing series with Sage Publishing's Social Science for Social Justice book series. This series reflects Sage's mission-driven approach to publishing by platforming emerging voices and enabling the dissemination of bold thinking that will inform the work of future generations of scholars and changemakers. In these episodes, we talk to authors from the book series about their research embedded in visions for social justice for all.
The book begins with Adam. I begin with his account on purpose. Adam is someone that I know personally in Denmark who was stopped by the police. They essentially held him down at gunpoint with assault rifles because he was sort of driving in, for him, the wrong neighborhood. It was an affluent neighborhood. And the police saw him as a threat. So he was taken in and then dismissed. And it was a very powerful experience for him. Adam told me he wants to see a psychologist. And when I asked him why, he said it's because he wants to prove to the police that their intervention, the way they pulled him out on the street and pointed guns at him, was very, very, was a very terrible experience. But he told me when he made an appointment with a psychologist, he didn't actually feel traumatized. He didn't know what trauma was. He just understands sort of intuitively, like there's some sort of like mental health language that we should be using. So he said, okay, I'm going to go see, I went to see a psychologist. So now reading from the book on page 3, Adam's account of his psychological consultation was comical to the point of satire. In the first session, the psychologist held up a finger and asked Adam how he felt. The psychologist is most likely introducing Adam to eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. It's called EMDR, which involves finger tracking. EMDR interventions are often employed for trauma. Adam felt nothing, but he still needed to give the psychologist something to work with. Anger, Adam responded to the psychologist's question. Okay, what if I slowly start moving my finger to the right like this, asked the psychologist. Angrier, Adam responded. And if I move it back, really angry. Adam's story was interrupted by bouts of laughter, the table shaking as we labor to breathe between bites. It makes for a tragic scene of dark comedy when a person feels forced to bluff a trauma response to hold the police accountable. In the end, the strategy failed, but not because the psychologist became privy to Adam's plan. Rather, Adam felt the psychologist was taking his performance too seriously. He was worried he was about to receive a mental health diagnosis, when he just needed something, a piece of paper perhaps, to present against the police. I'll jump now to page 5 as to why I introduce with Adam. It may seem strange for a book on psychology and statecraft to begin with Adam's story. In my years of writing, teaching, and organizing on psychology and Islamophobia, I recognize a book ought to begin with a more impersonal account, list the official statistics of Islamophobic hate crimes, explain that Islamophobia is a form of racism, as any other racism, with a real and demonstrable impact on health, display the astounding statistics of mental health problems in the Muslim community, especially as a result of discrimination, offer a public health strategy towards the eradication of Islamophobia, pray my writings will be read by policymakers. Perhaps if I follow these guidelines exactly, there's hope the inner and outer conditions of Muslim distress would be understood. But this is not such a book, not because there's no truth to these arguments. There certainly are. This book takes a different approach because I feel something is lacking in our current racism and mental health discourse. This lack becomes more evident when we speak of Muslims in the global north. In this lack, our capacity to dream an alternative future is disrupted. We cannot see beyond incessantly trying to improve the institutions we find ourselves in.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Surviving Society. My name is Dr. Chantel Jessica Lewis. This is the first episode of the Sage Publishing Social Science for Social Justice podcast. In this episode, I'm so excited today to be joined by Dr. Tariq Younis, who is a senior lecturer in psychology at Middlesex University. He researches and writes on Islamophobia, racism in mental health, the securitization of clinical settings, and the politics of psychology. He teaches on the impact of culture, religion, globalization, and security policies on mental health. As a registered psychologist, he primarily works with individuals who've experienced racism, Islamophobia, and state violence. we're going to be talking about Tariq's contribution to the Sage Publishing's Social Science for Social Justice book series. Tariq's contribution is a book called The Muslim State and Mind: Psychology in Times of Islamophobia. This is such a beautifully written book. It's such a deeply personal and political reminder of how entrenched and embedded racisms, and in this case Islamophobia, is in society and within the disciplines of how we understand ourselves more broadly. And I just think that when scholars like yourself, Tariq, make these kind of contributions, one thing that I always want to sort of put forward to listeners and say is that, like, it takes a lot to write about these things in this way, particularly if you have both lived experience and a very real and intimate understanding of how these both social and individual processes affect our everyday lives. So I just want to thank you as well for writing this work and producing this work, because it's so important. And welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Yeah, I really appreciate you just giving me an opportunity to, you know, share my thoughts and, you know, offer your amazing platform. I've always been a huge fan, as I was mentioning. I'm always listening to your podcast anyway, and it's just a great opportunity to be here again.
Oh, Tariq. Yeah, and listeners will know, Tariq's alumni. Like, we last had Tariq on the show back in 2020, we were talking about mental health and prevent, weren't
yeah.
we?
Yeah, we were talking about how prevent was embedded, I think, I guess more widely in healthcare, like healthcare settings.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, a lot has changed. I mean, not much has changed, but things are also getting worse, so that's also a whole different subject.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, we're gonna get into it obviously on this episode, but Tariq, like, just in our pre-chat then, I'm just reminded of how many different organizations and interventions you're involved in. Like, you are a proper scholar activist, like, in action. Like, you're producing the theory, writing the theory, and you're doing the work on the ground. And I think it's such a great example of how you can, like, both be a scholar and also be involved in community work. So yeah, I think that's incredible. And I guess on that note, where did that come from inside of you to want to pursue work in this way?
I mean, I think I need to maybe start off by saying that I'm really standing on the shoulders of many giants. You know, there's many people who precede me for decades doing this exact sort of work. Mm. One of the people who I won't mention by name, but she is a big inspiration. The only reason I'm not mentioning her by name is because that's, you know, sort of her choice.
Yes,
she doesn't want
to
be put in the forefront in that light. But she's really been doing it for decades. And so she's a supervisor and a mentor of mine, and I'm really trying to follow in her footsteps. So, you know, I think people can see me, but they can't see the footsteps that I'm following in.
Mm.
And that's just one of many people who've really inspired me, including yourself and, you know, others who've been doing this sort of work, you know, podcasts, you know, working within the community, for the community. It's not this sort of deeply artificial sort of intellectual art exercise where everything becomes a point of, like, putting our name on the top of an article or things like that. I think things like that have always struck me as artificial, I think. And I think that's where I feel the best sort of work is always done, on the ground, really getting, you know, your feet in the soil and getting the temperature of what's going on with people.
That's beautiful. And, like, what I love about that is that you have immediately referenced an individual collective of people that inspire you. And, like, I think we do better as academics, activists, organizers, thinkers, to sort of say that, look, no person is an island, are they? Like, we follow in the footsteps of people, but how we come to understand ourselves and the society we live in, or how we come to produce work that hopes to achieve social justice, is always collaborative, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think there's a very strong impulse to, like, individualize our work. And even in therapy, when I'm working with clients, you know, I always try to emphasize the fact that I don't speak in I speak in we. So even if you're speaking with me, you know, there's this invisible sort of community and support network. And you might not be looking at them right now, but with me and through others, you know, there's a lot more support than we can actually see at one time. But that impulse to individualize it and be like, I'm speaking with you, you know, is really powerful. And we always have to kind of, I think, hold on to that tension and be like, yeah, I'm working with someone, but really I'm working with many and through many. And that's, I think, our way forward.
Because even in that kind of therapeutic setting, you're emphasizing that we, but then in kind of in a hope that that we goes outside of the room as well,
yes,
but then
absolutely.
That person then works as we as well. That's so beautiful, Tariq. Thank you so much for that. So what's really interesting about this conversation and having you on the show again in this way is it's not, I don't think it's a secret that I'm not always the biggest fan of psychologists. And that very much comes from both my sociological training, but also like a lived experience of psychology, which hasn't necessarily taken seriously how race, gender and neurodiversity impact my sense of self and how I come to understand the world. But like, I'm trying to get that kind of mistrust into more of a critical friendship of psychology. And it's definitely people like you, Tariq, which identified to me that there are some absolutely brilliant psychologists out there. And of course, I don't want to be critical of a whole discipline of people, but you are like, you're my favorite psychologist, I'd say.
I can hopefully expose you to many other great psychologists.
Yeah, of course. So how did you get into psychology?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, you know, it's funny because I think this brings us full circle with what we were talking about before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I grew up as a racialized Muslim, very clearly Muslim, you know, in Germany.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so I was born in Canada. If anyone thinks I have an American accent, that's blasphemy. So it's important to, you can't call a Canadian American these days. So I was born in Canada. I grew up in Germany, you know, and especially in a sort of post 9/11 context, you know, I've seen and I've been exposed to, you know, I think a lot of the very sort of explicit violence which occurs.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking here of state violence and different ways in which people were imprisoned without charges, for example. But also sort of the implicit violence, right? Just the different ways Muslims have been racialized and securitized. And I think, you know, in my late adolescence, I was really already kind of involved in a lot of community work. I used to work a lot with youth. And at that time, I was actually studying whatever. Like, I mean, I was just kind of coasting through life. But I realized, you know, I need to maybe find a way to, you know, spend more of my time and energy thinking of how to, like, support these youth. So, you know, I think the idea of psychology just kind of came up. But I never thought of psychology. So I think people, there's some research done on how people enter in psychology. And I think I don't want to stigmatize or mm-hmm. demonize any individual person's experience. But, you know, I think there is a tendency for people to have gone through experiences themselves personally and be like, okay, I've gone through this experience and I want to help other people through that experience that I had, right? And psychology is sort of like a vehicle for that. I think my approach came really from, I'm kind of recognizing that there's these issues going on in the community itself. And I'm like, okay, how are we going to like work with this? Now, psychology, as you were saying, is, you know, psychologists aren't that great for that. You know, psychologists technically, in terms of our training, it's almost necessarily always going to individualize problems. And I think very early on, I felt very suffocated in my training because of that impulse in psychology to like individualize social, political issues, you know, socioeconomic conditions, and make it about, you know, an individual survival. And we can see that here right now. Like, it's very visible, you know, so many people suffering through a cost of living crisis. And psychology comes sort of as this, you know, I'm being a little bit reductive, but, you know, as a way of like, okay, you're feeling depressed, you're feeling anxious, if you can make it. You know, there's a talking therapy for that, if not medication. You know, feeling really uncomfortable in my university and that training, I ended up going to all these other institutions looking for critical people. That's where I ended up going to, like, different institutions, or I would say research places, like, it's called transcultural psychiatry.
Yeah.
in Montreal, they had a very sort of, I guess, kind of critical cultural perspective towards understanding distress, taking in sort of the fact that psychology is really an artifact of Western history and kind of decentering it a little bit. And I became then much more focused on thinking about the sort of sociopolitical conditions that people are going through. So that's, yeah, I think that marriage between my own experiences working in the community and then sort of being inspired by, you know, I guess a select few psychologists, psychiatrists, at that point it becomes a really fine line of people who are like, you know, critical of the disciplines and what they're actually achieving on the ground and what we could possibly, you know, co-create with the rest of the community in trying to support them.
Tariq, question for both me and the listeners. In layman's terms, what is the difference between a psychologist and a psychotherapist?
A psychologist and a psychotherapist? Well, that's a really good question. So I think psychologists, you know, these are, they're very fuzzy.
Yeah.
People can become psychotherapists without necessarily, let's say, becoming clinical psychologists. So psychology itself can be sort of divided into different disciplines like counseling psychology, clinical psychology. There's also like forensic psychology, you know, working in prisons. And psychotherapists, people can be practicing psychotherapy, but they might not be psychologists, so they can be counselors. So I think psychotherapy is more the actual practice of what someone can be doing. So a psychiatrist can be practicing psychotherapy. And we know psychiatrists like that. So the psychiatrists, even if they have a medical background, you know, they can be like absolutely against medicalizing their patients. And they'll be like, I'm practicing exclusively psychotherapy. Whereas psychologists would be more like that official designation or profession that you acquire at the end of your education.
Fast forward to sort of now, Tariq, like how long have you been working and living in Britain and like how did you end up here?
Yeah, it's the question I always get. I ended up here in 2017 on a research fellowship that I was awarded through the British Academy. I was very fortunate.
Whoop, whoop, whoop.
Yeah, so they, you know, it's really thanks to that fellowship that brought me here. I mean, the reason why I applied here, there's like a personal reason, I guess a professional reason.
Yeah.
So the personal reason is the fact that, as I had already described, so I grew up in Germany and my family still lives in Germany. My wife's family comes from Denmark, or, you know, they're based in Denmark, rather. They're not from Denmark. We were personally trying to find a way to come back to Europe because, you know, with kids, it was just became a little more complicated to travel from Canada to Europe all the time. Professionally, it was the PREVENT policy where I think kind of like maybe tying a full circle to like how I've slowly evolved. You know, I felt like one thing, even among cultural psychologists, psychiatrists, even the critical, those who are very critical among them, there wasn't a really sort of serious taking of politics. Mm-hmm. You know, there wasn't that much thinking through what's, you know, what's the political climate like here, how we're operating within this political climate. In Canada, I already knew of counter-extremism and counter-terrorism strategies, but when I heard of PREVENT, I was like, that's it. This is like one of the first really explicit like policies that are like embedded in mental health settings. That's very clear. It's very explicitly a political maneuver, right? Like it was just, you know, a political strategy that was embedded within healthcare settings. And I was like, this is like a great opportunity to explore that link between sort of these political strategies and racialization and mental health. Like it's because it's very difficult to put those three together, I think, in many people's minds. So here's a political policy that became, so for people who don't know PREVENT is a public duty in public bodies. So like hospitals, schools, nurseries, whatever, where staff are required to have due regard in identifying people who might become terrorists in the future. which they called it pre-crime. You know, if anyone has seen Minority Report, it's kind of Tom Cruise standing in front of like a terminal trying to like identify, you know, who's gonna commit what crime in the future. In practice, it's really about institutionalizing gut feelings. But because terrorism is such a highly racialized construct in public consciousness, we know it very well in research that when you talk about terrorism, it's conjuring a very particular type of people. And so I was like, okay, here's this colorblind policy, colorblind because apparently prevent is supposed to also be for white people, right? But, you know, very explicitly racist in many, many ways, being embedded in a mental health setting. How are mental health professionals working through it? And so I think that's what really brought me here. And that gave me, an opportunity to really explore how psychology and mental health disciplines continue to sort of perpetuate the status quo of the political climate that we're in.
What's really interesting about what you've said so far, Tariq, is that so you got here in 2017, and I know, like both professionally and personally, how embedded you are in different community organisations and scholar activism. And you're such a brilliant example of kind of digging where you stand and like an understanding of what your kind of discipline and training can bring to this work of resistance. And like, you've only been here since 2017. I didn't realise, I thought you'd been here ages. And like, I can't believe how many different initiatives you're involved in. This is incredible. It really, really is. Okay, let's go on to the book. Talk to me about the book. What kind of motivated you to write this book?
The way I came to write the book is actually really probably a simple follow-up on everything I've explained so far. You know, I felt like there's like a politics of psychology that's important for Islamophobia and sort of the racialization of Muslims. And there's the politics of Islamophobia that's important for psychology, psychologists, and mental health professionals, right? So it's like this two-way street between politics and psychology where Muslims are sort of in the center of it, which, to be frank, many people have been writing about for decades, and specifically on the process of racialization and especially the colorblindness of mental health disciplines. You know, we know mental health disciplines have like a long history of, you know, kind of managing ideal citizenry. We know that from like the civil rights movement in the United States. You know, mental health diagnoses were a political tool in ensuring that, you know, Black activists couldn't purchase weapons, for example, to defend themselves, right? Like, there's long histories here with racialized communities. And so, you know, people have been writing about this for a long time, but I kind of felt like this wasn't super accessible to many. And I felt maybe also there's a way of accentuating Islamophobia in particular as a very particular form of racialization, which would include other forms of racialization as well. And I bring an example of that, of like a Black Muslim on the streets of London. You know, I know this has happened. This is something that happened for real. You know, he was taken by the police, you know, and frisked through stop and search policy, right? Because he was Black. But then when they discovered that he was Muslim, he kind of became securitized through that. When they found a knife on him, his violence, the racialization of the violence that he embodies, you know, took him in a different direction as well. So he became securitized through the war on terror. And that was figured through a logic of like, you know, counter extremism, right? And like that intersection is something that we haven't really captured too well. So my book doesn't necessarily cover all of that, but it speaks to like just the importance of thinking through, you know, for, I guess, at least as much as I try for the wider public, why, you know, Islamophobia is very revealing of how psychology operates today.
Why do you think it is that intersection's been neglected?
I don't know. I mean, I think there's an element potentially of like identity politics, and like we all sort of just embody like very almost like it's discrete identities. Like, this person's Muslim, this person's Black, right? And I think that's always worked against us in like solidarity of like the common ways in which, you know, the political forces or, you know, the political climate that we're in, like nationalism, racialize us all on the boundaries, you know, of whiteness, mm-hmm. essentially. So I think, you know, just people have written a lot on that. I think it's a massive failure. I mean, if we look at hostile environment, you know, we look at, as I was saying, stop and search policies, we look at counter extremism strategies. There's so much commonalities between them. And in fact, you know, it's really a disservice to ourselves that we're not able to, I guess, mobilize on them collectively as a sort of as like a collective of security logics that operate on racialized bodies. And I think, yeah, we can probably do better there.
That's such a good point. And I guess it would be good, like, for the listeners to talk a bit about the kind of last 22 years, really, like thinking about 9/11 and thinking about psychology's contribution to kind of normalizing like politics of the war on terror and how that's in, like, the politics of the war on terror, how that's affected Muslim communities in particular. And like, it's so interesting hearing you talk about that kind of like that process of racialization then becoming a securitization issue. And like, it's almost like it's like a double jeopardy.
Yeah.
And like, even listening to you speak now, it just makes me so angry, but also just so aware of how normalized and embedded like Islamophobia is. But as soon as you add the kind of other intersections, so if you're racialized communities, like gender, nationality, like it's just like, things are not getting better, are they? And if we look at that kind of the last sort of 22 years, it feels like a real, and I don't, this is why I'm asking you to sort of talk about this, because to me it seems like it's intensified, but perhaps actually it was already there and it was just brought to the surface more. Yeah. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think it's always been there.
Yeah.
I think people have been writing about these things for a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of like the psychology of it, if you know, towards your first point, I mean, I think psychology as a discipline, first of all, has a long history of securitization.
Yeah.
Like, I think we have to be really clear there, you know, like psychiatry and psychology are, you know, one of the biggest harms.
Tools of the state, maybe.
Yeah. I think they're not only like tools of the state, but I think one of the biggest harms, I think, for many who study it, who maybe sort of engage in mental health disciplines, is that it tries to give this veneer of it being apolitical, right? So they're like these apolitical fields.
Yeah.
But in assuming that it's apolitical, it's really just reifying and reproducing all these, like, the tools of the state sort of logics, right? So, I mean, psychology, I think, has, even in the war on terror, like, a long history of, from, like, explicit involvement of psychologists in torture, you know, in the Middle East. You know, we know that for a fact right now, obviously. And, you know, movies been written about that and everything. But I think more implicitly, you know, I think psychology and the war on terror has revealed how much, you know, there's this sort of pre-crime risk-based logic that's embedded in societies.
Yeah.
Of like trying to capture people before they commit a crime in any way, shape, or form. So there's this, you know, there's a great line by Giddens. I'm not gonna cite scholars, but you know, this line is so good that I think it's worth just attributing it directly to him. He talks about how the future is colonized by risk. And so like we live in a time right now where I think we can even see it in sort of the political discourse that it's almost like everything is perpetually under threat in the future, which then sort of racializes very particular bodies that are associated either with violence, with threat, with non-belonging, you know, like all these things come together. And then like policies are formulated on that. And I think the way I think psychology, and I write about this in my book very, very explicitly, you know, psychology comes, it gives this air of benevolence to it. Like, we're just trying to help people. You know? Like, and I think that's the part that's really frustrating for me. But I think it's the part that's most, that makes it most sort of acceptable for the public, is that, let's say, you know, someone comes, you know, and they say something that, oh, I find a little bit weird. And, you know, my immediate gut feeling might be that, you know, I don't like what this person said, right? Maybe it sounds like, it's no explicit threat or anything, right? But it strikes me in a weird way. And I think it's really important to emphasize that these gut feelings of like, oh, something struck me in a weird way or whatever, or associated with threat, is highly racialized. So I want to make that point very clear. You know, for white people to get, for them to provoke that feeling, generally they have to be really explicit in like threats or associations with like white supremacist or neo-Nazi groups. That's often what makes, you know, in the war on terror, that's often how they're captured. But, you know, let's say a Muslim youth is very upset with something that's happening in the Middle East, right? And I should mention, very legitimately upset. You know, they might be upset with some settler colonial occupation that's going on, right? And this strikes a teacher as, oh, this kid has a problem managing their anger, right? But now the prevent policy, what it does is institutionalizes that gut feeling. Okay, so that's what we know that already. So they'll make a prevent referral because they don't feel like that kid is managing maybe their anger, they can't manage it well. But this is where psychology comes in, because it allows that sort of benevolence in like, well, I'm just trying to help that kid in like becoming more well-rounded in their emotions. You know, if they're depressed because of what's happening, you know, outside of Britain, this will help address that depression, as if that's the problem, right? But psychology has always done that. It's just very clear this is how it's also operating within the war on terror.
That's such a brilliant answer, Tariq. And like, it's really made me think about like who gets both policed and who gets policed when it comes to critical thinking about the world. Like, who is allowed to think, research, understand what's happening around them in a critical way, and that is extremely racialized. We had a really great episode a few months ago with Prevent Watch, and we were talking about like how, even though it's important for us to kind of have that conversation about whose ideas or who, like, whose critical thinking gets quote unquote police, and then who gets referred to prevent, but also that we don't want to then say, well, these white kids that are reading or thinking about or spouting views from people like Andrew Tate, like they need to now be referred to prevent. And that's why this work is so transformative, that you're so transformative that you're doing, and so crucial, because it's not a race to the bottom. It's like we have to take people with us, even the ones that are pushed towards a politics of hatred.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that I'm not now saying that the example of the young people you gave is an example of people that are being radicalized, but what I'm saying is those that are racialized as white or that are engaging, and the facts are, it's not just white men in particular that are being radicalized by people like Andrew Tate, your Manosphere people. It's a whole range of, it's a multi-class, multi-ethnic issue, as with all of patriarchy. But like, what's really important about this work is that we don't want any securitization, we don't want any policing of gut feelings, do we?
No. Yeah, absolutely not. I mean, at the end of the day, any expansion of security will always be much worse for racialized communities.
Yes.
I mean, I think that just point has to be very clear.
Yes.
You know, and I think I often get that critique when I talk about prevent or anything. You know, people will be like, but can it be, you know, modified to like just get the far right? Or can't we do better at getting white people? You know, but like that argument has already been sort of totally dismantled in the war on drugs in the United States. You know, it's not like police officers in the United States are being asked, go pick up black people off the street. They're not. Yeah. That's not how it happens.
Yeah.
They're being told, go look for, you know, go look for gang members, whatever it might be, these highly racialized constructs. And within a prison industrial complex of just like trying to get as many people as possible, that's how it happens, right? Like the whole point is that if something's inherently racist, by trying to capture white people, you're just sort of anchoring it as a policy, as a strategy. And white people are not going to get more captured through it. Because their bodies alone will never be sufficient.
Yes.
Right. So that's the whole point of racialization, right? Is that my argument against Prevent was never that it's only against Muslims. My whole point is that the threshold difference between what would bring a Muslim, a racialized Muslim, and a white person to be referred through that institutionalized gut feeling is humongous.
Mm.
It's humongous. A white person just on the street will never inspire in a police officer a potential thought of, is this person a gang member? Is he carrying a knife? You know, if the person is a racialized Muslim, is his anger associated with extremism? You know, because their bodies alone don't conjure these images.
It's so powerful, and it's just such a key example of like, our politics can't be a race to the bottom.
Yeah.
It can't be. And that's what makes our politics different and more loving and transformative. And like, I genuinely believe, and I'm putting this out there to manifest it, I think in our lifetime we're gonna abolish Prevent.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I think we need to abolish Prevent alongside so many other things.
So many other things. But
like, the gang matrix was recently the sort of like taken down. You know, like, I think all these things have to work hand in hand, you know? I think if we, like, I kind of feel like if we just abolish Prevent on its own, you know, but sort of maintain all the, like, the hostile environment or other things, you know, it just doesn't accomplish much.
No, exactly, Ryan. Thank you for checking me on that, Tariq. Okay, tell us about the Coming Home Project.
Yeah, for sure. So the Coming Home Project is kind of an evolution. I think myself and Maslaha, and there's also Lantern Initiative.
Big up Maslaha and the Lantern Initiative.
Yes, absolutely. I'd like to especially also give credit to Maslaha for being also the ones who are funding it. And I think that's really important. We need to recognize who's actually putting in, you know, the sort of financial backing to it. So it's been a long time coming. I should mention that for myself, I kind of still work as a practicing psychologist or a clinical psychologist, but my work is almost really exclusively working with people who've been securitized or experienced state violence, police violence in different ways. That's something that evolved, I think, very organically from the fact that, you know, if anyone's following the conversation so far, will recognize that people don't feel so comfortable, let's say, going to like a public body like the NHS and talking about these things for many different reasons, right? Like, let's say someone comes and says that they're absolutely angry against the police. You know, what is that going to conjure in a mental health professional? Is that suddenly a Prevent referral or angry towards the state? You know, things like that. So there's a total lack of, I think, safe space when it comes to these things. And so I've been working with them privately, but I've recognized that many different sort of NGOs and charities have been kind of doing their own work, but everyone's sort of kind of isolated. And I think the purpose of this Coming Home Project was really to facilitate and make it very explicit a means of support for anyone who's been securitized, anyone who's experienced police violence or state violence. And as a means of a referral system for these NGOs that, you know, people can come here. And they'll be able to speak with someone. It's free of charge for anyone who comes at point of access. And we really want to, I think, really start consolidating a system of support that's maybe not dependent on, I guess, mental health settings that are explicitly and increasingly securitized, right? And not because, oh, we want to create like parallel systems, but in effect, it's because of securitization and, you know, the racism that we're seeing in healthcare and the NHS that demands that we create these community-based services.
Honestly, it's incredible. So could you just talk to the listeners about how it's going to work in practice?
Yeah.
Like, how will you be accessed and et cetera?
Well, we just launched, but I mean, it's very simple. So if anyone goes on the website, hopefully maybe we can share it.
It'll be in the episode notes.
Yeah, great. So you can just click on that link and you essentially just go to a form and you can fill it out and request to speak with someone. And we're going to continuously sort of improve the process and try to empower the individual to make their own choices of who they want to see. You know, I think these are really, really important things. And to also, I think, be very holistic. So people might need different things. So I think the whole point of such a service is that we want it to evolve very organically with the needs of the community. So nothing really top down saying, this is what you guys need. You know, oh, maybe you need like whatever. 5 sessions of therapy or something. That would be an absolutely ridiculous approach. You know, that would technically almost be sort of like the NHS approach,
yeah.
Right? So we don't want to do that. We want people to come to us with their needs and make it then incumbent on us to, you know, develop some flexibility in holding these people, again, as part of a wider community, making it in relation to all these various NGOs and charities, and finding ways of supporting people much more holistically.
And will it be primarily done online or?
Yeah, well, that would depend on, so that's part of it.
Yeah.
Like, so I think that flexibility is that if someone comes and they say they only want to see someone online, then yeah. But they say they want to only see someone in person, then absolutely, right? Like it's just one of those things where if everyone comes to us and they're like, I don't trust online, for example. I'm just giving an example.
Let's
say I only want to see people in person. That's the sort of thing we want to increasingly also document and be like, okay, we really need to like maximize on our offline space and find something that's much more, I guess much more appropriate.
Yes.
For people who've been securitized, experienced police violence, state violence, whatever it might be. So I think we're very open to ideas. If anyone's listening and they're like, oh, you know, maybe you need to think about X, Y, Z. I'm really happy to hear what you have to say. And, you know, I think for us, you know, we're really in it to make it, to address a community need.
Yeah. Right?
Like we're not in it for anything else really, right? So if it addresses a community we need in any way, shape or form, we're happy, right? Like, I think that's what we need to work towards.
Oh, this is just, it's just so inspiring to sit and talk with people like you, Kat Tarek, honestly. How do you, in doing this work that is so high pressured and so, so crucial, like, how do you look after yourself?
Luckily, the footsteps of people, many of the footsteps of people that I follow in are still alive and around. So that helps. You know, I think I often turn back to people that inspire me. I'm not going to mention all their names, but I really hope they know who they are, you know, where I'm feeling insecure, whatever it might be. And I turn towards them. That's what a community is, right?
Yeah.
A community, we feel held. It's not like we have to, like, lay it out in, like, a form, who's holding me right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's an experience where I'd be like, okay, I feel held. Certainly, you know, that doesn't completely take away with the anxiety, but the anxiety itself, I think, is informative. If I'm feeling anxious, you know, I remember that, you know, at the end of the day, I've been privileged in knowing that there's all these people looking out for me.
Yeah.
You know, which I think a lot of people don't have that experience.
Yeah.
If there's one experience I really want to inculcate in communities is that, you know, you're not alone, you know, and there's people looking out for you. We obviously need to develop that more. Right.
Yeah.
And so you know that you have all these things to fall back on. So I think that's something. And obviously, I think like on a personal level, you know, I have young children. So when I see them, you know, I think about, OK, what kind of world do we want for them? You know, like that's what we're working towards.
Yeah.
So I think a large part comes back to being inspired by like the next generation.
That's beautiful. And on that note, my final question. What are some positive, or what are some hopeful interventions and possibilities that the listeners can take away from your scholarship and the work that you're involved in? Obviously, we've just heard about the Coming Home Project, which is brilliant, but like anything else that you'd want to kind of flag that in this moment where the state feels the most oppressive it's possibly ever been, like where are our pockets of hope?
I mean, our pockets of hope are always where they've always been, really, solidarity,
yeah.
Right? Like,
yeah.
I think if anyone feels like they're listening and they, you know, they should know that there's a lot of work that's being done. We can't see them, I think, sometimes. But there's a lot of NGOs, like Healing Justice London is an example.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's a lot of NGOs and charities that are there, that are working sort of, you know, behind the scenes to support us.
Mm.
And my encouragement is to never, you know, you never resist alone, right? Like, I think there's like this impulse in society to make everything like you, this is on your shoulders, you go out, you do something. No, we think in we, right?
Mm.
Like you see something, you want to make a change, go see where people are stepping, you know, step alongside with them, work alongside with them. So that's, yeah. So MEDAC, Healing Justice London, you know, Maslaha.
Yeah.
I can name so many different organizations.
Yeah.
I should name those that I work with. They're really great. And yeah, definitely go join up.
That's it. So Social Science for Social Justice. Big up Sade Publishing. Big up Tarek Yunus. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Surviving Society.
To support our work, you can rate,
review and subscribe. To host or produce a series of Surviving Society,
get in touch with us via Twitter or Instagram.